Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play at Walt Disney World Resort.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, afoxolaner, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
Hi, welcome to the NASCAR and NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan, joined by NASCAR and NBC analyst, 1999 NASCAR Cup Series champion Dale Jarrett, who was at Nashville Super Speedway last night. And DJ, we're going to talk about last night's race, won by Ross Chastain, who ends a winless streak of over 40 races. Chastain wins from the pole, and he told you and Kyle Petty and Marty Snyder, DJ, on the post-race show last night that it was like when the sun went down, there was a light switch on the number one Chevrolet, and it came to life. So let's just start there. Like, what did you make about how good Ross Chastain was? Because obviously he qualified on pole, but that really, in this case, was indicative of how fast his car was and, you know, perhaps as good as a car as he's had in the Cup Series.
Yeah, it was. You know that there's speed there. And I think everybody wasn't exactly sure when the track was going to cool down enough to make a difference and how much difference was it going to make. I talked to a number of the drivers on Saturday about what could they really feel in the track with the resin that they had been told had been put down, because when I got there, on Friday, it didn't look like anything was on the track. It's not like the old PJ1 that you have. So they weren't sure, you know, how much the track was going to widen out. As it turned out, it was quite a bit. And they weren't sure exactly. They said their biggest problem is knowing where the grip is and what they can do. So that being said, I wasn't sure whose car was going to do what. It was quite obvious that once again, kind of like a replay of last year, that Martin Truex Jr. and Denny Hamlin were both kind of the class of the field when the sun was out and the track was still extremely hot. But I remember tapping Kyle Petty on the arm after the sun had gone down. I looked up and Ross had come out maybe fourth after pit stops or something. And I just watched him, that once he got past, may have been William Byron, he had a 2.9 second gap up to Denny and Martin. And I could just see him. He started clicking off and he was about a tenth and a half. Then it went to 2/10 quicker. And then before you knew it, he was running 4/10 faster per lap. And it was just, you could visually see his car do things that Martin and Denny couldn't do with their cars in the center of the corner. And you could tell Ross had kind of changed his style too. And I think, I'm not sure if it was Dale Jr. or Jeff Burton that alluded to it on the telecast, that Ross had kind of backed up the corner a little bit. And especially when he got close enough to those guys to make runs at them, he wasn't getting into the corner as deep, but he was getting his car turned and accelerating much faster than what they were. And boy, that's fun as a driver when you get things like that and they happen for you. Then he did a great job of maneuvering not only his car, but through traffic and stuff with some cars and lap cars that were just trying to stay on the lead lap, but that were making things a little bit more difficult for him.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a minute, because obviously traffic and other drivers making things difficult for Ross Chastain, that's been a theme of the last year and a half really in the Cup Series. But going back to what you said earlier about how the track changed, how the cars changed, early in the first stint when Ross was leading from the pole, he radioed in his crew, I think, that he said that he was feeling like there was too much tightness. And Steve Wotart said on our broadcast that might be a trouble sign, because you'd rather maybe be loose earlier and then as the track cools down, it would kind of come to your favor. But I guess looking back on it, however the Trackhouse team had the number one Chevrolet set up, do you think it was just that they were anticipating how the track would race when it got cooler, that Phil Surgeon, Ross's crew chief, and Chastain had sort of figured out, like, hey, we want to have it set up so that it's optimized and whatever he was feeling in that first run was going to go away when the track changed.
Yeah, I think one thing that they were looking at, because that, you know, with the race starting, and we literally started just minutes after 6 o'clock, trying to make sure that beat any rainstorms that might potentially come in later in the race, and never happened, thank goodness. And with it starting that early, I think the drivers that were on the tighter side were able to be comfortable in their cars. And I think that's what they wanted Ross to do, is just be comfortable with what you were doing there, but that they had a plan to adjust the car. And they made a couple adjustments at the end of stage one. I know they made some adjustments. And then their next pit stop, they made another adjustment to his car. And I think that's really whenever they started feeling that they were getting the grip from the track that they were looking for. Now they needed to make their car fit that. And that's been something that maybe they've been a little bit behind on some. And I think Ross had admittedly a couple of times said that when they had good cars, he wasn't giving them information to make changes because the car is good. And I could relate to that really easy. I can remember Rockingham many years ago, but I would lead a lot of laps and then Jeff Gordon would beat my tail at the end. But I wasn't adjusting on my car. And finally, after like the second time, I'm not that fast of a learner, but I said, you know, I'm going to adjust on my car. If I get it off a little bit, then we can always go back to what we had to make it as good as what we can get. And I think that's something that Ross has mentioned that he wants to do a better job of. And it looks like they did that last night and did it the exact right way. And you know, he needed every bit of the speed that he had to keep Martin Truex Jr. back there. I mean, Martin kept making runs at him and got up beside him a couple of times, but Ross never varied from what he was doing and just stuck to his guns. And he knew that if he didn't give Martin that outside groove, that he was going to be able to hold him back there, because Truex, even as good as his car was, I think his car tightened up a little bit in the center because he complained about the center being really tight, and then he was loose on the exit. And that came from just trying to get the car turned in the center. So it was a good job all the way around by Ross Chastain managing the track through the different conditions.
Yeah, he managed it as well as I think any of us have seen him manage a race in the Cup Series. Very much like a veteran, very much like yourself. And to give you a little bit of credit, DJ, I remember a race at Rockingham in 2003 when you out-dueled Kurt Busch late in the race because you managed the race so well. So got to correct the record there and say that you are one of the smartest racers in terms of being able to do what Ross Chastain did at Nashville last night. But let's talk a little bit more about how he did navigate traffic. And you and KP both talked about this post-race. Kyle Petty said that
the way you approach traffic, we watched you work traffic today. You didn't just run up on them and say, oh, now what am I going to do with it? And the one example was Truex is coming. And you can't get away from Eric Almirola. You cannot get away. Y'all are a magnet. Y'all are on each other. And you split them. You're patient enough. How much patience did it take in that situation? Because he was coming at that time.
Chastain was much more deliberate and calculated in getting through traffic. Ross kind of joked afterward with you guys about how Eric Almirola has been an ongoing kind of roadblock for him all year long.
And yeah, look, Eric and his man upstairs on the spotter stand, they got it out for me, and they're open about it. And like when we come up to lap them at Dover and here, it's like they're going to run me all over the track. And so I took a risky move. I felt like that was very high risk, but it was worth the reward to get that clean air.
Ross kind of took this risk to get clean air by scooting around Almirola as quickly as he could. And he said, well, you know, Eric kind of gave me a little bit of a pass. So what did you make of what we saw there from Chastain, and that it seemed like he was balancing the risks? He was still doing it, like that move on Almirola, but it seemed like he was managing things. We didn't see the impatient, I'm going to knock Brendan Poole out of the way to get to the front at Dover or stay at the front.
Yeah. You know, we all have to learn, you know, and a lot of times we learn the hard way. You know, you don't want to change what has helped make you successful. But in Ross's case, he has so much talent and so much passion for doing this, but he was letting his overaggression get in the way at some of the wrong times. You know, there's nothing wrong with the things to me that he was doing when he's racing up front and trying to win the races. It's the other things that he wouldn't get talked about nearly as much if it weren't the times that he really didn't have to be aggressive and running into people. If he could take those out of the equation and you know, instead of having maybe 8 weeks of that in a row, you only had – you know, 3 of the 5 weeks, because some of those could have been avoided very easily and wouldn't have changed the outcome of the race for him, but it would have kept a lot of people from getting upset with him. So you'd like to see him learn. I spoke with Ross. It was kind of after his first run on Saturday in qualifications, and he was waiting, and he was sitting on the wall, and I said, well, I said, you know, I know since Darlington, things haven't been the same with you. What are we going to see this weekend? And he said, you're going to see Ross. And I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, so the old Ross? He said, you're just going to see Ross. I said, I got you. And he just kind of smiled at me. And so I let him go from there, knew that he was thinking about, you know, the next round. And obviously he went out and won the pole then. But then Kyle Petty had a great point last night when we were talking. And I told that story a little bit, that, you know, what Ross had told me. And Kyle said, but what we also saw was a calculated Ross, and went in to explain that he was more patient with things, realizing the good car that he had. He didn't really ruffle. I can't tell anywhere that he ruffled anybody's feathers last night in going and winning the race. And the move that he made there with another lap car, as he was having some trouble getting around Eric Almirola, going in the middle of them, going into turn three, it was somewhat of a risk, but I think that there was enough room there to do what he wanted to do, and he didn't press the issue, but he took the opportunity that was presented. And I looked at that as kind of the winning move of the race. That put three cars between Ross and the 19 car of Martin Truex Jr. at that point in time. And so then all of a sudden, Martin's got the bad air of three cars that he has to deal with, and Ross was able to stretch things out a little bit. So, yeah, that's a different style than what we've seen before, because he was very patient with Eric Almirola, I think. Probably maybe even more than what he should have been. But, yeah, that's good to see that he's thinking along those lines, that, you know, you don't want to mess. I think, you know, it was something good that came out, too, whenever, you know, I think Dustin Long actually asked his car owner, Justin Marks, about the talk that he had with Ross.
Obviously, there's been a lot of talk the last few weeks. It's just that the results haven't been there, and it's, you know, Ross isn't as aggressive, and you've had that talk to him. Where do you feel like he is? And for those who suggest that this is like last fall, where he kind of, you know, was not as aggressive and it hurt him, that has he fallen into that trap again, or how do you feel like he is at this point?
Well, I think that the sitting down and the talking to and all that's a narrative that has sort of taken on a life of its own the last couple of weeks. I mean, I have not sat down with Ross and said, hey, do this, do that, like slow down, get, you know, like I've not had that conversation with him. I mean, I think the conversation has been, you know, hey, let's not waste opportunities we have to win, because winning is so hard, and you know, we need to win right now. And you know, we don't want to be losing opportunities. We want to be good partners with our key partners at you know, within the Chevrolet camp.
You know, everybody's kind of blown this out of proportion, as to, you know, the talk was that, hey, you know, you got to quit doing this and that. And Justin Mark's biggest thing was, hey, we got to win when we have the opportunities to win. He didn't tell him to stop being Ross and being aggressive. That wasn't the conversation ever. So I think that now that, you know, all of that is out there, but Ross took it to heart. You know, he mentioned quickly after his celebration of the things that he'd been dealing with, you know, hearing all the people talk.
This is incredible. This is why every little kid out there, anywhere in the world, when you get criticized, and you're going to, if you're competitive, they will try to tear you down. You will start believing them. You can't do it. You have to go to your people, trust in the process, read your books, trust the big man's plan upstairs, and just keep getting up and going to work. I got to tell you, a lot of self-reflection through all of this, but I had a group that believed in me, and they didn't let me get down, and they bring rocket ships, and I just try to point them to victory lane.
You know, I guess it would be hard this day and time not to hear all of the chatter that's out there. And in his case, you have to just sleep for 23 and a half hours a day not to hear the stuff. And so, but how you let it affect you is the biggest thing. And I think he's come to terms with what he needs to do, that he can be the driver that has gotten him here and given him this opportunity, but he can go about things in a little bit different way.
Yeah, and we heard Justin Marks say that before and after the race last night, DJ, that he felt as what he had said had been a little bit misconstrued, and that he, I think, essentially said, as you just put it, that he was trying to tell Ross, take care of my stuff, don't change your driving style. But I can understand, like, we're complicit in this, but I can understand how that kind of gets blown out of proportion, because I think when Marks did that initial interview, it kind of did come off as, we're going to talk to him. And I think it was natural for everybody to presume like, well, surely they're going to be talking about how to change his style. Clearly, he blended the best of both worlds last night, the way we've all kind of expected to see Ross do it. Like that aggression melded with that patience really made a difference. The way that he got through lap traffic and the way that, you know, he talked about, he was asked about how he drove differently, if he drove differently. He said, well, look at the two cars I passed to get the win. I think he was talking about Denny Hamlin, Martin Truex Jr., two guys who he's obviously had a lot of history with. Yeah. Do you think some of the things Ross has done since Darlington, I mean, we made so much about how he wasn't running up front as much the last three races. Do you think there were things he did on the racetrack that maybe we didn't see, or conversations that he had that earned him some dispensation or some leeway with some of his competition?
I believe he's getting a level of respect. I don't think there's anybody out there, as far as the drivers go, that doesn't believe that Ross Chastain is a potential championship caliber race driver, that he is tremendous talent, can do a lot of really, really good things with a race car. But, you know, there's only been a few people to come along that could make people mad on a regular basis and get by with it and still win races and win championships. And Ross hadn't been put in that category yet. And, you know, maybe he will get to that point. But I think what people are seeing is that it really did bother him. And the biggest thing, I don't think it was the other competitors, and he kind of said this last night that bothered him, but when Rick Hendrick called him out.
Look, when Mr. Hendrick criticizes publicly, it's tough. I mean, sure. he is the guy that everybody knows, and they know that he, you know, if what he says goes, he deserves that. But I took that, and he said, you're going to win again, Ross. Like, you're going to keep competing. Just do it a little better. Don't crash my cars, please. So
that got his attention. Rick Hendrick carries a lot of weight in this sport, in the world, world of business. And you don't want people, you want people like that on your side, especially when you're driving a Chevrolet also. You know, you want to be in good favor there. And who knows? I mean, I know that right now Ross plans to finish his career at Trackhouse, but we all have those things, you know, those ideas whenever things are going well at a place. But, you know, there might come a day that Rick Hendrick wants to call Ross Chastain and say, hey, I've got this seat open. I want you to come drive for me. Don't know that'll happen, but you don't want to make Rick Hendrick mad anyway, because you know, he can affect a lot of things out there. And so I think a lot of people realize that, you know, Ross was intentionally trying to calm things down a little bit after, you know, the Darlington incident with Kyle Larson there on that restart. And, you know, I looked at that as hard racing could have been avoided. He might have been able to win the race without getting the lead right at that point. So I think that he reflected on a lot of those things. And probably the biggest thing was, you know, Justin Marks telling him, hey, take the opportunities that we have. You know, at that time, they were leading the points. They had, you know, were kind of putting some space between themselves and the second place, right? And that was going to be another opportunity for him to do that. Then in the next four races, you know, they've fallen quite a bit behind because of things happening like that. Well, I mean, he lost a lot of points right there at Darlington. But I believe drivers are seeing that there is some compassion there that Ross has and understanding of other people and how some of his actions were doing that. And that's going to be appreciated. Now, they're not all just going to say, oh, okay, Ross has changed and everything's good. As we saw Eric Almirola racing really, really hard. Some people aren't going to forget, you know, they're going to. And we've said this, Kyle Petty and I said it for a long time. Jeff Burton said it. Dale Jr. said it. You know, anybody that's driven understands that to pay somebody back, you don't have to go wreck someone. Yeah, that doesn't have to happen. You right. can make life miserable. Matter of fact, you can do things for a longer period of time to make things miserable for them. Now, Eric doesn't want to be making it miserable because he's getting lapped all the time. But when those opportunities are there, he's going to make. That's probably the fastest that Eric ran all night was trying to make life harder for Ross during that time.
And Ross might have a few of those still coming from Kyle Larson, like you said, not necessarily intentionally wrecking him, but
yes,
not cutting him any slack or any breaks either. But I think you're right. I mean, you raise a great point that not only did Ross address the critics right away in his post-race interview with Marty Snyder, almost like steering away from the question that Marty was asking, but then, during his Peacock Pitbox interview with you guys as well, he made a point of saying that Rick Hendrick, that really was what affected me. And you're right. I mean, if Ross Chastain wins a championship, which I think we all think he's capable of, Rick Hendrick, I don't think that door is ever going to be closed, because we know Rick Hendrick likes winners, likes champions. But I want to ask you, DJ, because you asked Ross about that. I mean, we all knew he was going to make the playoffs. But like you said, he was leading the points until this slump. And you never in until you're in. Now he's definitely in. And you asked Ross afterwards.
So after a performance like this, I know you came into the year after a tremendous season last year, having an opportunity to win a championship last year, coming in thinking, okay, we're definitely going to be that good, if not better. But you couldn't get a win until this point. Took 17 races, 17 weeks to get to that point. You're still thinking, I'm sure, before that you were a championship caliber team. But does this kind of talk about flipping a switch? You're obviously in the playoffs now, but championship caliber?
I have no idea. Look, I am figuring this stuff out as I go. I have been here since 2011 in the Truck Series, and Kentucky was my third race ever, which is very similar. And when I sit here, I think of Kentucky. And to now, like, to come here and win this many years later, I have no idea what that means for the future.
What did you make of what Ross said to you after you sort of put it out there, like, hey, aren't you a championship contender now?
It probably, to be quite honest, because we talked so much and the other questions had been about the race and they covered a lot of stuff, it might not have been a fair question there, because he's trying to enjoy a win, you know. And, you know, this win came with no consequences of anybody being mad at him, other than the guys that Denny Hamlin, Martin Truex Jr., that he outran. You know, they're not mad at him. They're just, you know, wish that they could have beat him. But so he didn't make anybody mad. He did this. You know, Steve Letard had brought the point up early in the race that, you know, his two wins, as much as we talked about how great a season his last year was for him and everything, to this point, his two wins had come on a road course and at Talladega. And that's not taking anything. You have to have great skills to win at those places too. But Steve Letard was saying, hey, we need to see him win on what we would call a normal oval. So my question may have been a little bit soon. The answer, I understand. You know, Ross is so genuine that some people, I would think that maybe they're just kind of dodging the question and, hey, I don't want to think about that until it's time, you know, and I just go race. But Ross really means that, you know. Yeah. He truly just wants to go race. He, you know, he's ready to go to Chicago now and see what that brings, and then move on to the next one after that. He knows that because of last year, but because of what this team and what he was able to accomplish, that they are championship caliber material. But he doesn't want to go throw that out there. You know, if he goes and says that, and all of a sudden people say, well, you know, he's won one race and now he's bragging about it. You know, here he's making himself the favorite. So I hate that I kind of put him in that position, but he handled it very well. And again, I think he was very genuine in that. We'll be the ones to talk about that. He certainly is a championship caliber driver, and they're that kind of team too.
I thought it was a good question, and I thought it showcased something I've heard from KP. You know, KP has been on this podcast before and talked about how he and Ross have kind of developed this relationship away from the racetrack. And Kyle Petty has talked about that Ross Chastain's humility kind of goes overlooked sometimes, that even though he's got this brash, aggressive side on the racetrack, off the track, I wouldn't say he's like the swaggery kind of pounding his chest kind of guy. But that being said, I think what you just said is really important, DJ, that he hadn't had that win yet on an oval. Okay, Talladega is its own beast.
Yes.
Nashville isn't like a lot of other tracks on the circuit, but it almost felt as if he needed to win at a place like this to really feel like he was a championship contender. And like you say, he's probably not going to admit that publicly and doesn't really want to stir that up. But I would think to his team, to Trackhouse, that's why this was such a statement victory. Never mind that it also happens in Nashville where Justin Marks and the team are based.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I'm a huge fan. You know, we're supposed to be as impartial as we can in this business and what we do. But you know, I really enjoy, I spend time talking to Ross at the track. I'm always interested in listening to him and hearing his side of things to begin with. And then, you know, what he's thinking, because I'm really interested in his career. I like where he came from. He drove cars that simply just were not good cars, just to be there, just to be in races. And everything that he ever drove, he made the car finished better than what it was capable of actually doing. And so I'm always interested in people like that. But I've also developed a relationship that I can pick up the phone and call him. I can text him. He'll get right back to me. I'm trying to get him to quit calling me Mr. Jarrett. But other than that, we have really good conversations. And the paint scheme at Darlington was a really cool thing they were able to do. You know, fortunately, he has a sponsor that has a big tie-in with UPS. You know, that was great to see. So we've, you know, kind of had this relationship. And again, I just enjoy talking, more listening to him. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have to ask a long question, which I'm capable of doing, but I can just ask him a simple question and get a really, really good answer. And I do appreciate his talents. He is very, very humble and very appreciative of the opportunities that he's getting here.
That's great insight. And yeah, it's really cool how that his Worldwide Express sponsorship kind of has that UPS yes. tied, which has created that connection, which you mentioned, that scheme at Darlington, that throwback was really cool. So the controversy here, DJ, with Ryan Blaney, where he hits the unprotected wall at the end of pit lane, no safer barrier there. I want to talk about that, but first let's talk about the crash itself, where Ryan Blaney had locked the wheels down as he was coming through the front stretch grass. So clearly he was on the brakes, but as he reached the pavement, the wheel started spinning, meaning he released the brakes. And he talked about this afterward, that he was surprised that the car didn't turn, essentially, when he released the brakes. And he still had probably, 60 or 70 feet until he got to the wall there, but he wasn't able to turn. Can you relate to that, your experience as a driver? Does that just happen sometimes where you come off the brake and you think you'll be able to turn and then you can't?
Yeah, you know, it was really strange to watch because there are some things about this car that are totally different. And that seems to me to be something that I feel like that I had seen this before. It may not have ended up in a head-on crash like what Ryan Blaney had last night, but it seemed like that the drivers aren't able to get the cars to make as big a turns as what the old cars used to be able to do, and that you could rely on that. I understand exactly what he was trying to do and what his expectations were, and that was what was so strange. It was like it looked almost like he hit the gas, you know, that the car took off so quickly once he hit the pavement. It almost like it accelerated, but in turn, he thought that he was going to slide into the barrier if he just stayed on the brakes. And if he hits the right rear with that, you know, it's going to break the toe link and then, you know, he's going to be out of the race. So I understand what he was trying to do. I think he was totally surprised by the fact that this car didn't do what they have known to be able to do in the past. And, you know, it turned into a very unfortunate and scary looking incident. And I'm still concerned for him. I know that he was, you know, released, you know, and I know Steve Attard and the NBC people did a great job of showing exactly how these cars have been changed from last year for safety issues. All of that's great. I hope that's that. But you could tell that hit stunned Ryan Blaney. And I just hope that it was just the matter of it happening that took him a little time to recover from, and this isn't another concussion type incident because we don't need something like that happening. But, you know, it was a vicious hit, and those head-on collisions like that are very difficult, especially I have no idea, and I know we're going to get into this, but I have no idea why there is a concrete barrier anywhere that a car can get. As crazy as it sounds, cars find these places on their own sometimes, and you just never know. So I hope this shows that NASCAR and everyone else, that every track, once again, that if it's anywhere, you know, within 300-400 yards of the racing surface, then it needs to have a safer barrier on it.
Yeah, it's disappointing that we're still talking about this 8.5 years after Kyle Busch had an injury that took him out for 3 months because he hit an unprotected wall at Daytona during that Xfinity race. What gets me, DJ, is like I hear these explanations and reasons that are tied to cost. But to your point just now, I mean, let's hope Ryan Blaney is okay. I mean, certainly we hope that he's not out. But if he were to miss time or miss races, whatever it costs is worth the investment versus losing drivers from races, right?
Yeah, and we're not even talking about that big of a section, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like that goes down a long way. Down in the middle of the corner down there, that doesn't really, where that wall would continue on, don't think that's a place that anything's going to get, although you never know. But, you know, you had to be able to figure that there is that possibility. We see, you know, through the tri-ovals at different racetracks that cars come down across the front of there. So you, it's not like, I don't want to hear about expense. I'm sorry. Yeah, that should not even be a factor in this when we're talking about safety this day and time, and especially with what we've seen with this car, with concussions and drivers. And I realized that Kurt Busch did hit a safer barrier, but that just shows how finicky these cars are and how touchy they are, and you know what an issue this is. And I realize everybody's working hard with the cars, but we just, the people working on the cars, we need to make sure that everybody's doing their job. And this is something that has to be addressed. And you know, I know we're going to a brand new place this weekend, coming up at Chicago, and you know, there's different barriers and different things there, but I hope that a lot of time has been taken to look at the different possibilities there. But as far as the ovals go, I hope that everybody, you know, I hope Atlanta is looking ahead and saying, okay, do we have everything covered here? If something should happen, that we make sure that we have done our job and forget about the cost of it. You know, I don't want to put anybody out of business, but I don't think the cost of that's going to do that. But we can't be putting these drivers in more harm's way than what they already are.
No, absolutely not. Safer barriers everywhere. And encourage everybody to check out Dustin Longstar at NBCSports.com. And he asked Ryan Blaney after the wreck, and Ryan said somewhat jokingly, but somewhat not, I'll pay for it myself if I have to. Yeah. And I think all the drivers would say that. And to your point, I don't know what it costs. Like, I can remember when they outfitted Richmond with the safer barrier all the way around in 2003, it was about $750,000. I mean, I'm sure it's more now, but that was an entire 0.75 mile track. And we're talking about a really small section. So it's worth whatever investment it is. Hopefully they are looking at that in Chicago. I want to get to Chicago in 1 minute, but Nashville Super Speedway. Why is this track racing? Like, so I don't think anybody would have expected this in 2021, that it would emerge as such a great racetrack.
It's incredible. You know, I never raced there, but I've watched a lot of races there. I actually did, you know, testing like a lot of people, since it wasn't on our schedule, you know, back in the early 2000s, we could go there and test and it not count against us. I found it a very difficult track. So it just amazes me when I see things like these guys running three wide for the lead on a restart for, I think it was at least 2.5, maybe 3 laps. Behind them, it was 2 wide and sometimes getting 3 wide. It was just incredible racing. I think the car has a little something to do with that, that they're able to do that car and experience of these drivers. It was incredible to watch that. I mean, that was stuff that even when we see it happen at Daytona and Talladega, you realize that those tracks are wide enough and what they're doing, they're capable of doing there. But this is not somewhere that you would think that you could run three wide for that long. And it wasn't even just the three wide. It was just incredible racing throughout the night. It, you know, all of it wasn't always for the lead. We panned back and showed, you know, other battles and the concrete surface and the lack of banking. As I talked to drivers on Saturday about the conditions there, that seemed to be the thing that was brought up more than anything, was that, you know, the unpredictability of concrete surface and then the lack of banking allows them to do that. So it's made for really good racing. I don't think that anybody could walk away from there or turn their TV off last night and say, man, that wasn't a very good race. If you did, I don't know what you're looking for. And you certainly wouldn't be a Formula One fan, because that wouldn't fit in at all. But it's just incredible. And yeah, you have to give the drivers some credit too, to understand that they can do that, was just amazing.
Certainly hope we don't see Formula One style racing at a Formula One style track that NASCAR is going to this weekend. First time ever in 75 years in the history of the Premier Series, NASCAR will be racing at a street course. So I've been trying to think of a way to ask you this, DJ. It's a little bit unique. There's nothing you can really say until they actually get there or on track. And I know we've analyzed it to death what we think it's going to be. So let me ask this. I was looking at the NBC Sports travel grid, and I noticed, I think only one person is renting a car from our huge, big contingents that's going to Chicago, which I'm sure makes all the budget people in NBC Sports very happy. But it's a little bit unique for those in the traveling circus of NASCAR. So have you ever stayed at a track and walked in every day without being at a motorhome lot? I mean, is this going to be a completely new experience for all of NASCAR and all of the drivers and teams to be doing it this way?
It is going to be very unique. And I think that the good thing is, Nate, I think everyone understands why it needs to be this way and why it's taking place this way. And, you know, that the amount of attention that this is getting, I think we're all willing to sacrifice a little bit. If you, I, be quite honest, I stayed in Chicago a lot. I never did really enjoy driving around in that city anyway, so with a car. So I'm perfectly fine not having a rental car. Good restaurants all around, and, you know, going to be able to walk from our hotel right over to the pit box and, you know, go through pit lane is and all of that stuff and by the fountain. So I'm excited about that opportunity and to see a race weekend turn out like this. So it is going to be something completely different. Everyone has done a tremendous job. Julie Giese in particular has really done a phenomenal job. You know, the pictures that we showed yesterday of the stands being up, of the fan zones and stuff that are being set up, just incredible. The excitement throughout the city there is much higher than it was when it was first announced. The excitement around the world, I mean, the ticket sales have just been incredible where, you know, all 50 states and, you know, I think she said five continents and 15 countries that they have sold tickets. Just amazing interest that this has garnered. Does it need a great race to finish it off? That would be icing on the cake. It's going to be a huge event and happening anyway. Something that NASCAR's never done. Chicago's never had a street race there. You know, it's going to be very interesting to see how it all comes off. I know the drivers are a little apprehensive, and if I were driving, I probably would be too, going to something and not getting any more time on the track than what they're getting. It was funny that because I had been up there and a number of the drivers as I was walking through on Saturday as they were getting ready to qualify were asking me because they had seen that I had been up there and they were like, so what is this part like? You know, where's, you know, how bumpy is it going to be? I said, hey, I was riding around in a van. I don't know exactly how bumpy it's going to be in your race car, but I said, it doesn't seem to be that bad there. And I said, but I did tell them, I said, I think your biggest challenge is going to be going from the asphalt to concrete, concrete to asphalt. And a lot of that happens on entries and exit of corners. And that's going to be something I think that they're going to battle a lot. But the whole process is going to be something totally new, different than what any of us have experienced. And so I hope everybody goes in with an open mind. There's so much stuff going on around it. Once it gets to race time, it's going to be interesting to see exactly what does happen on the streets of Chicago.
Should be a huge event, you know, and as someone myself, I went to college, went to high school in the Chicago area. So this is truly exciting. And to see Parker Kligerman do those stand-ups during our race in Nashville yesterday with the skyline in the background. And, yeah. You know, as you mentioned, Julie Giese, she said that I think 70% of ticket sales are fans who aren't in NASCAR's databases having attended races before. So,
yeah, wow.
You would think the exposure level here is going to be pretty impressive. The race itself, that'll be sort of the icing on the cake, but I think certainly there's going to be a potential for chaos, and that always means a potential for another winner. And, you know, as I'm looking, we're talking here with you in your office, and I can see the 1999 Cup Series Championship photo behind you, which is pretty cool for people who are watching on the Motorsports on NBC YouTube page, but that makes me think of playoffs. Yeah. I think Ross Chastain gives us 11 winners now with 9 races to go in the regular season, so 5 slots left in the 16-driver field for the playoffs. How many more winners do you think we'll see? Because I think we all knew Ross was probably going to be in regardless. So I guess in a way it doesn't change the calculus too much. But I mean, we still got Chicago. We still got Watkins Glen. We still got Indy Road Course. Got Atlanta. Got Daytona. A lot of X factors out there.
There are. These next 9 races have more wild cards. We used to just talk about, you know, Daytona kind of being the wild card. But we've seen so many people, AJ obviously comes to mind, that everybody's kind of making him the favorite this weekend for a good reason, probably. I mean, he's really the only one that drives these cars on a regular basis that has street racing experience, and see how that factors in. But you think about others, Daniel Suarez, who won at Sonoma last year, become a good road racer. You know, we've seen Chase Briscoe run well at Indy. Michael McDowell's been a factor at a number of these road course races. So to think that we could have 2 or 3 different winners on just the road courses themselves and the road course plus the street race, and then you throw in Daytona, I really didn't think we would get to 14 this year. And I'm not so sure that we're not going to get to that and possibly get to that 15 number once again. I think that's a very real possibility. You know, when you're sitting there with Chase Elliott, who hasn't won a race yet, but, you know, showed a lot more potential last night, probably his best race since his injury and coming back. And, you know, you got to believe that he's going to be a factor in a number of these races. And then, you know, Kevin Harvick is sitting there. He had a fast race car till he had that flat tire last night. So you got to think that there's going to be somewhere that he's going to get in the mix and be able to win. So I think we might be looking at that 14, 15 number again. So, you know, talking about points is only going to be for a number of drivers there. And that is tightly packed back there where they are now since that number changed. So, you know, we kind of had a little talk and debate last night. You know, is there a path for Chase Elliott to get in, you know, just on sheer numbers? And he you know, he gained 20 points there last night to that number. But as more winners come along, that number gets to be something different. And so I think they realize that they probably need to win. So this is going to be fascinating. The potential's there, you know, not starting out with, you know, kind of getting multiple winners or winners with multiple wins. It kind of slowed my thinking down, and I think a lot of other people, but I think I'm getting ready to ramp up with what we're seeing that, you know, we might even, could we get to that 16 number? It's certainly not out of the question in my mind right now.
I know it's probably still a little bit of a long shot, but it certainly seems feasible.
Yeah.
Five winners in nine races does not seem so daunting when you consider the schedule ahead.
Not with these nine races we have here, yeah.
Anything could happen, and the good thing is it's all going to happen on NASCAR and NBC starting this Sunday, Chicago on NBC. DJ, really looking forward to seeing you there and really appreciate you being on the NASCAR and NBC podcast. And it was a tight turnaround for you from Nashville. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Nate. Appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you in Chicago.
Our thanks again to Dale Jarrett for joining us on the NASCAR and NBC podcast, which he taped after catching an early flight out of Nashville from a late Sunday night at the track. Really appreciate our resident NASCAR Hall of Famer DJ for his time and wisdom, as always. Thanks to Motorsports Manager Emily Conboy for coordinating this episode, and for Zach Catanzaretti, who is editing the Motorsports on NBC YouTube channel version of the podcast. You can catch the full episode there, as well as some notable clips from DJ. And also check more NASCAR America Motor Mouths content and highlights from across the racing spectrum on the Motorsports on NBC YouTube channel. For the first time in its 75-year history, NASCAR will race the streets of Chicago this weekend. And I'll be on site with Dustin Long, NASCAR Talk editor. You can go to nbcsports.com/NASCAR for all the details and schedules for how to watch the Cup and Xfinity Series races, as well as news, columns, and analysis on NASCAR Talk. I also will have coverage of IndyCar at Mid-Ohio on Motorsports Talk, so please visit nbcsports.com/NASCAR or nbcsports.com/motors for all your NASCAR and IndyCar coverage and Super Motocross from Dan Beaver as well. If you have any NASCAR and NBC podcast feedback, you can send to me on Twitter at Nate Ryan is my name. Thanks again for listening to the NASCAR and NBC podcast.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, afoxolaner, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
Is there such a thing as a traveler? Not a Delta. Because we know on one flight, Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. While on the flight after, 8C is occupied by Jen, whose favorite snack is tea. That's why we provide fast, free Delta Sync Wi-Fi available for SkyMiles members. Because at Delta, we know. Refill? Everyone flies their own way. Delta. Keep climbing. Free Wi-Fi available on most domestic flights. Terms of use apply.